This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next presentation is going to be on portopulmonary hypertension, and it's given me great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Van Selby. Dr. Van Selby has been at UCSF for a long time, right?
Yes.
Starting with MD degree at UCSF, and then residency in internal medicine, and then the cardiology fellowship, and also a advanced fellowship in heart failure and heart transplant at UCSF. So So Dr. Selby is gracious enough to accept this invitation to talk to us about portopulmonary hypertension. And Dr. Selby is a recipient of a prestigious research fellowship award from the Heart Failure Society of America, and has really done a lot of clinical studies on advanced heart failure and portopulmonary hypertension. So I should mention that portopulmonary hypertension is not a rare entity that we very often encounter in the setting of end-stage liver disease. Dr. Selby?
Thanks. Thank you. And thanks for inviting me to speak right after three of the great transplant luminaries at UCSF. It's slightly intimidating, but I'll do my best. And I know we're past due for a break, so I'll go as quickly as possible. I'm glad this topic is included today, because we work a lot with the hepatologists at UCSF on kind of co-managing these patients and achieving the best outcomes. Here's the overview for today. So if there's one thing to take home from today, it's what is portopulmonary hypertension. And the part that's in blue, the elevated PA pressures due to increased resistance to blood flow in the setting of portal hypertension is really important. It's a disease of the pulmonary arteries, not just high PA pressures. To have it, you do have to have high PA pressure. So we use a mean pulmonary artery pressure of 25 millimeters of mercury at rest. And then you also have to have an elevated pulmonary vascular resistance. We use 3 Wood units as our cutoff. And that's really getting at that resistance to flow in the pulmonary arteries. To meet criteria, you also have to have normal left heart pressures, and we define that as a pulmonary capillary wedge pressure less than 15 millimeters of mercury, or a transpulmonary gradient, which is just sort of the pressure gradient across the pulmonary vasculature greater than 12, meaning that you've got some disease beyond just the elevated wedge pressure. And it's important to remember that you can see actually moderate or even sometimes severe PH due to other reasons in liver transplant candidates. And we'll get to that in a minute. But this is sometimes not portopulmonary hypertension, and it's important to know what you're dealing with. So this is how I think of pulmonary hypertension. I think this helps facilitate discussions between cardiologists and hepatologists. So pulmonary hypertension just means high pulmonary artery pressures. And that's a mean PA pressure greater than 25 no matter what. And you see here on the side, this is how we break down all the different causes. So you have pulmonary hypertension due to left heart disease, lung disease, chronic PEs, unclear mechanisms. But portopulmonary falls in this category of pulmonary arterial hypertension, which you will also hear is called group 1 PH, which is actual disease of the pulmonary arteries themselves. And that includes things like idiopathic, which is the most well-studied form, HIV toxin-associated. But then portopulmonary hypertension fits in there because, again, you have disease and remodeling of the pulmonary arteries. So what's the epidemiology of portopulmonary hypertension? So you see very, very widely ranging prevalences in liver transplant candidates, anywhere from as low as 3.5%, which I think from my experience is definitely too low, at least for the UCSF population, up to as high as 16.1%. Females are at higher risk. Autoimmune hepatitis seems to be a particularly frequent cause. Hep C is a little bit less frequent. And one thing to just keep in mind is it's not directly correlated with the severity of liver disease. And this just brings that home. So if you look at the last row here, it gives the association, or the correlation, I should say, between the MELD score, if I can get this up, the MELD score and all the different invasive hemodynamics we look at. So things like the mean pulmonary pressure, there's essentially no correlation at all. Cardiac output, there's not much correlation. Actually, essentially zero correlation with PVR itself. So it's not just the most advanced end-stage liver patients who get pulmonary portopulmonary hypertension. Why do you get it? Well, so there's certainly some component of increased portal pressures. That's the first hit. But why do only 3 to 16% of patients actually get true portopulmonary hypertension? Nobody has really proven with any certainty the exact mechanism why some people get it. People have hypothesized and shown with some success that there are higher levels of certain substances that are usually cleared by the liver in these patients. They may moderate some of the remodeling. There may be a genetic predisposition. This is kind of grows from the fact that we do have a familial pulmonary hypertension, in which some specific well-described mutations increase the risk of PH. People think maybe the people who develop portopulmonary have some of those same genetic risks. Thromboembolism of the portal system. And then just hyperdynamic circulation of cirrhosis, meaning that you have such high flow over such a long time in patients with cirrhosis that maybe that leads to pulmonary vascular remodeling over time. Again, none of these have been shown for sure. We really don't know exactly why some people get it. Pathologically, it actually looks very similar to idiopathic pulmonary hypertension. So the straight arrow is some of the intimal thickening and fibrosis that you see. The curved arrow is what we call plexiform lesions. These are just sort of hallmarks of pulmonary arterial hypertension, and again, reinforce the fact that this is a disease of the pulmonary arteries. You also frequently see in situ thrombosis of the pulmonary arteries. We see that in all forms of pulmonary arterial hypertension, and I'll get to why that's significant in a minute. So one challenge that we sometimes have to deal with is figuring out exactly why someone has high pulmonary artery pressure. So here are three states that that can cause high PA pressures, and you can see any of them in cirrhosis. So we know cirrhosis is, generally speaking, a high cardiac output state. That alone will give you high pressures just because you have increased flow. But what you'll see is the pulmonary vascular resistance is not high in that state. So someone may have a PA mean pressure of 35 but a PVR of 1. That patient doesn't have portopulmonary hypertension. Just pure volume overload. So I feel like I see this all the time in the liver transplant patients we consult on, oftentimes because they're in end-stage renal failure as well. But for whatever reason, they get volume overloaded. That drives up the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, and then that gets transmitted back to the pulmonary circulation and gives you pulmonary hypertension. Again, here are the hallmarks of and the reasons it's not portopulmonary is the wedge is high and the PVR is really not that significantly elevated. The last one, vasoconstriction and proliferation and thickening, is what we see in portopulmonary. And you see the PA pressures are very high. The PVR is very high. Cardiac output we'll get to in a second. And the wedge pressure is normal or low. So this is how we sort of think through why a patient with advanced liver disease may have pulmonary hypertension. So this is just sort of the trajectory of not just portopulmonary, but any pulmonary hypertension. So the yellow line is the pulmonary pressures. They go up as the disease develops, but then you get to this stable plateau in many cases where the PA pressures don't really go up much more. And that's because cardiac output starts to plateau and even sort of decrease as time goes on. Then you see patients start deteriorating substantially after a couple of years usually, to where the pulmonary pressures may actually come down because the cardiac output is going down and they're not seeing as much blood flow to the pulmonary arteries. So you can't just look at the mean pulmonary artery pressure to assess the severity of someone's pulmonary hypertension. Portopulmonary hypertension is clearly associated with poor survival. So these are just basically two Kaplan-Meier curves showing survival in portopulmonary compared to idiopathic. The portopulmonaries are the lines on the bottom in both graphs. We think of idiopathic pulmonary hypertension as a relatively severe disease with poor prognosis. Portopulmonary hypertension is clearly much worse. Some of that is due to the underlying liver disease that can kill them for other reasons than just progressive heart failure. Some of the important prognostic signs are the cardiac index is an important marker. When that gets low, you're in that sort of burned out end stage of portopulmonary hypertension. And then also the severity of the cirrhosis, not surprisingly, predicts death. So what do we do for these patients? Well, we know that no therapy alone has a very poor survival. All the patients in those registry, in that registry data I just showed, were on some sort of therapy. Medical therapy alone is okay, but still a poor five-year survival. Transplant alone is better than nothing, but still has poor survival. And really what we go for in these patients is treating the pulmonary hypertension to get them to the transplant. So we'll go through how we do this briefly. So when you first have a patient with portopulmonary hypertension, things you can think about right away, other than just getting them to the cardiologist, is A, do they need diuresis? B, what do you think of anticoagulation? So we anticoagulate idiopathic pulmonary hypertension all the time because they're at increased risk for forming thrombus inside the pulmonary arteries. In liver patients, it's almost always contraindicated due to either coagulopathy or thrombocytopenia. But if you have a patient who is not severely coagulopathic or thrombocytopenic, it is something to consider, because at least in idiopathic pulmonary hypertension, anticoagulation has been shown to improve survival. You want to be very hesitant with beta blockers in these patients, especially if they have right ventricular dysfunction. And then things like TIPS, anything that alters your venous return and overall hemodynamics is just risky in these patients because they're more tenuous. So what pH-specific therapies can we do? I think this is just a good list to go through, because a lot of your patients with portopulmonary hypertension will be on these meds. They have lots of different names, and each class has different agents, so it's important to just recognize what they're for and know, have a general idea of what class they're in. So we at UCSF like phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors. Sildenafil is the classic one. It's a three-time-a-day med. It's one of the few that's actually been studied, albeit in a very small cohort. It did lower pulmonary vascular resistance, but those benefits were not seen out to a year. A lot of times now we're using tadalafil, which is also called Adcirca, because it's once daily dosing. The next class is the endothelin receptor antagonist. Bosentan is the oldest. We're using it less and less, and especially in these patients, because it can have some hepatotoxicity. Ambrisentan is a slightly newer one, and macitentan is the newest. It's been out for a couple months now. The company that makes macitentan is actually in the planning stage of a clinical trial of macitentan for portopulmonary hypertension. So it'll be nice, because it'll be one of the bigger clinical studies we have of a therapy in portopulmonary hypertension, and it'll be very nice to see if what the benefit is. We use a lot of these medications in portopulmonary, just extrapolating from studies in idiopathic and other types of pulmonary hypertension, but these patients are rarely included in the trials. Prostacyclines we'll get to in a second. And then there's a new class of medicine. The only agent approved so far is riociguat or Adempas. You probably won't be seeing it as much in your portopulmonary patients. It hasn't been studied in them. It's mostly being used in pulmonary hypertension due to chronic thromboembolic disease. So this is a nice study that came out of UCSF a while ago now, 2007, looking at Flolan. Flolan is epoprostenol. It's our oldest and far and away best prostacycline and overall best therapy for pulmonary hypertension. Here you see that in portopulmonary patients, it has all the effects you want. It lowers the mean PA pressure, lowers the transpulmonary gradient, and actually has some inotropic effects. It boosts the cardiac output and index and lowers the pulmonary vascular resistance. The main limitations to epoprostenol, which is also called Flolan, are that it requires an indwelling catheter, and it has an incredibly short half-life. So patients have to be very competent and able to deal with any issues that may come up with the line. So if there's any drug use going on in the patient, if there's any, you know, dementia or any sort of reason why we don't trust them to call and come into the emergency department the second anything goes wrong, we can't use this medication. Side effects, it causes a lot of headache, jaw pain, flushing. The biggest thing we see in liver failure patients is it can worsen thrombocytopenia. And then obviously complications related to the catheter. The other prostacyclines, treprostinil or Remodulin, is something you'll see us use a lot. It's got a longer half-life, so you can use it in patients who you don't quite trust with Flolan. We've been using a lot of Tyvaso, which is inhaled Remodulin. It's nice because it doesn't require a catheter. And then there's a new oral form. At UCSF, we're actually not using it yet, just because there's not as much data. But it will probably come into increased use in the future. And then there's another one called Ventavis that you may sometimes see. So liver transplant, it's associated with high mortality, as many of you probably know. And I think this image kind of nicely summarizes exactly why that is. So a normal heart is is here, and you see the RV kind of sits as a sliver along the left ventricle, each of them doing their job. In pulmonary hypertension, the right ventricle gets enlarged from all the stress, and that just really throws off the whole heart. The LV left ventricle gets small, doesn't fill properly, doesn't eject properly. And the increase in the right ventricle throws off oxygen supply demand and increases myocardial ischemia. So you kind of get this negative feedback loop in the heart that makes people unable to tolerate really any stressors at all, liver transplant being a large hemodynamic stress. So that's part of the reason why they do so poorly. This is one of my favorite studies from portal pulmonary hypertension liver transplant, because it just shows so clearly what the how significant a predictor of adverse outcomes it is. So mean pulmonary pressure, those with PA pressure less than 35 all survive. Those with a PA pressure greater than 35, 50% mortality. Similarly, the transpulmonary gradient, those with the high gradient, 50% mortality. Those with the normal gradient all survived. Really just drives home the how big a risk factor this is. So because of that, we aggressively screen and patients at UCSF, we have this protocol we use, echo for all, and then we use a right ventricular systolic pressure cutoff of 40 to decide if they need further screening. If the RV pressure is not that high, but there's something like a right ventricular dilation or other evidence of pulmonary hypertension, we'll also screen with the cath. So we do right heart catheterizations, and these are the criteria we like to see: a mean PA pressure less than 35 and a pulmonary vascular resistance less than 3. Importantly, if they meet these criteria, they have to get a liter of fluid and show that even with the hemodynamic challenge of a fluid load, they can maintain these criteria. This is just some of the other unique situations we'll get into. Sometimes if they have the elevated PA pressure but a relatively normal PVR, they may be those patients with just high left-sided disease, so not actual portal pulmonary hypertension. In some of those cases, we'll let them go on to transplant, but it's kind of a patient-specific decision. Also, it's just important to note that those are very borderline criteria, so if they're right around the cutoffs but not quite there, sometimes we'll look at them a little more closely, making sure their right ventricle is okay, making sure they're going to tolerate the transplant. Finally, for those we treat, and we end up treating a lot of these patients with those exact agents I just went through, we like to see that they can maintain these on treatment. And sometimes they'll get intermittent right heart caths to confirm that they can maintain these numbers while they're awaiting transplant. Just to show that different institutions use slightly different criteria, here's Mayo. They use a PA mean-based criteria as well, but they'll go up to 50 millimeters of mercury in some cases. We don't tend to be that aggressive. If the PA mean is that high, we get really hesitant to let them go forward. But there's a fair amount of center-to-center variability. Here's just one last diagram of how Mayo, at least, manages pulmonary hypertension that's found when the patient goes to transplant. So say they either weren't screened adequately or have developed portal pulmonary hypertension. They look, is the mean PA pressure less than 35, and is the PVR low? If so, go ahead. If the PA pressure is kind of borderline, they look at the PVR and the right ventricular function and use that to decide whether or not to go to surgery. If the PA mean is greater than 40 at the time of transplant and the PVR is high, then they hold off on surgery. So this is one algorithm of how you can deal with kind of surprising portal pulmonary hypertension. People always ask, does liver transplant cure portal pulmonary hypertension? And I'd say there's some data to suggest it may, some data to suggest it may not. There's really not a consensus opinion. I've seen wide range in reports showing either benefit or progression of the PH. So I generally don't love to think of just portal pulmonary hypertension alone as an indication for transplant. It is sometimes considered as one, but I feel like it's such an aggressive treatment for it, and there are other therapies we can use for PH that ambiguous outcomes, it's a little bit overkill to go ahead with that. So to summarize, I'd say on average for most of the studies, portal pulmonary hypertension will be present in about 8% of your liver transplant candidates. It's very, very crucial that you screen these patients because it really makes a huge difference in outcome. Speaking both just from the limited data that are available, but also from clinical experience, you really can get these pressures down. So get them to someone who knows, who's comfortable treating PH with these advanced therapies. And we like to go straight to multiple medications at the same time up front to really get their pressures down, and then repeat the cath, see if we're making progress. If not, just go up and up on the medications or switch medications, eventually often ending up with Flolan to get their pressures down. Liver transplant probably benefits patients with portopulmonary, but medical therapy is good these days. We now have three different classes of medications. We can treat it in many cases, so I think that's usually the better option for these patients. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Great summary. Let me ask the first question. So if you see a patient, say, who has dilated right heart, PA pressure is very high, PVR is very high, you know, and then you're trying to think about transplant, is there a threshold when you say this patient really has no chance to get the PA pressure to meet transplant criteria?
So not one that's been proven, and if the patient is otherwise a good candidate and someone you really feel like is going to have a good outcome if you can treat that, we'll do Flolan from the start. And you go for the most potent. So you'd probably do Flolan and sildenafil. Crank it up and up and up. Some patients can tolerate huge, huge doses of Flolan. Some can't at all, but you basically go up until symptoms limit them. And sometimes it's shocking how much improvement you can see. You also have to look at the patient and say, are they going to be alive, you know, 6 months from now when the Flolan really reaches its full effect? So it's a discussion between the cardiologist and hepatologist.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.